Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin. On today's show, I speak to Dr. Emily Thomas, Associate Professor in Philosophy at Durham University, who takes us on a unique journey of discovery with her new book, The Meaning of Travel. Part philosophical ramble, part travelogue, it traverses the places where philosophy and travel intersect and questions the value of voyaging from the age of discovery to the present day. Well, not quite the present day, because this conversation was recorded whilst we could all still travel. Emily, welcome to Monocle Reads.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
This is such a lovely and timely book, The Meaning of Travel, and it really, well, it's perhaps the first ever book on philosophical issues around travel.
I think it literally is the first ever book on philosophical issues around travel. There's some philosophical work on issues in tourism, but this is the first book ever to take a broader look at philosophy and travel.
Mm-hmm. So where did the journey begin for you?
For me, it began with two different things. One is that I've always been obsessed with travel. Independently of my career as a philosopher, I've done lots and lots of backpacking, and I've continued to travel even once I had a proper job that made backpacking tricky. And the second thing was that a few years ago, I had finished a big project, and there was suddenly a bit of an intellectual void in my life, and I had a big trip coming up, and my brain just became obsessed with thinking about putting these two things together, philosophy and travel. So I started doing research, and I wasn't sure actually how much I would find, and to my delight I found lots. Philosophy and travel have been tangled together for centuries, and each has affected the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, take us back to the beginning, to those voyages in the age of discovery.
So I think that Western philosophers began to get interested in travel around this age of discovery, so 15th, 16th century. And the age of discovery was this period in European history where people began sending ships out across the seas. They were looking for new trade routes, new lands to colonise. And this process had been going on for a while. And then philosophers began getting really interested in travel as well. And so I think the interest starts with Francis Bacon, who is an English philosopher. And Bacon is really wondering, how should science work and what role can travel play in the advancement of science?
Why do philosophers care about travel?
I think philosophers at heart care about understanding the world and the universe we live in. And there are lots of different ways of understanding the universe, but going out and seeing what it's like is a good way. And so I think part of what philosophers care about is knowing how things are in other places. That gives them data to understand where they are right now. Descartes talks a lot about how travel helps us to shake our assumptions, to shake assumptions that are so deeply rooted we don't even realise they are assumptions. Mm. And I think that huge value of travel is still with us today.
I mean, you say in the book, the philosophy of travel isn't a thing, but it should be.
Yes, absolutely. Both things are true. The philosophy of travel is not something that there are conferences on or university courses on. It's not something that you see discussed. But actually, I think that there is this philosophy of travel that's sort of seeping through in bits and pieces, almost kind of hidden throughout the centuries. Mm. And what I've tried to do is bring that out and show people this really has been here all along. It should be a thing.
And you talk about the fact that philosophers sometimes compare their inquiries to journeys.
Yes, often, in fact. So we have, for example, some lovely passages in David Hume's work. Hume was a Scottish philosopher in the 18th century, and he's famous for being a sceptic about everything. Hume isn't sure that we exist as a self, let alone that the sun might rise tomorrow. He's really a sceptic about all forms of knowledge. And At the beginning of his big book about scepticism, Hume talks about how he's setting off on this voyage of discovery. And about halfway through the book, he describes himself as a shipwrecked traveller who's perched on some rocks overlooking an ocean. And then he's come so far, but he's not sure that he should venture out further into unknown seas. But off he goes and does it anyway. And I think what's going on in this metaphor is that a lot of what philosophers try to do is map the things that humans don't already know. We're trying to ask new questions that have never been asked before. I think the first time someone asked, what is goodness or what is time, you like to think that they are really mapping an area of knowledge that we don't understand, but we want to. And I think that has a lot in common with voyages of exploration into outer space or beneath the sea. We are mapping the unknown.
You also ask the question, what are maps?
I do. I love maps. I must confess, I'm a little bit obsessed with them. I like to hang them on walls. I've got lots of books of maps. But despite how I've always appreciated them, it never occurred to me that they were anything other than what they appeared to be, a representation of reality. And when I began digging into the philosophy of maps, I found that actually they are far more than that. They are really opaque objects of power, and they are seeking to persuade us of what they represent, not just represent things. So to give you a really straightforward example, what map makers place in the centre of a map really matters. Whatever goes in the centre, they are telling us, is at the heart of the world in more ways than one. So if you Google European world maps, you will see Europe bang in the centre. If you Google Chinese world maps, you'll see China in the centre. And I think that's a great example of the way maps are trying to persuade us of where lines of power lie in the world.
And all those old empire maps and, you know, the whole world coloured blue or red or whatever it was.
Absolutely.
So interesting. Now, you have a chapter entitled Francis Bacon on the Philosophy of Science and Frozen Chicken.
I do, yes.
Tell us about that.
So, back in the 15th century and earlier, if you wanted to figure out the nature of a thing, say you wanted to figure out the nature of an oak tree, a philosopher might sit in his armchair, and of course all scientists were philosophers back then, you didn't have the distinction, you would sit back in your armchair and you would say to yourself, well, what is a living thing like? And then you might work up to the nature of plants and then the nature of trees and from there to the nature of oak trees. So the idea was that you could figure everything out about the world from your armchair. And Francis Bacon, who is watching these voyages across the seas very closely, says, no, no, this isn't right. Surely there is another way to do science. And so he develops a new philosophy of science based on people going out into the world and gathering things and bringing it back. And he thinks that the more data we have, we can refine our theories. We can then test those theories by going out and gathering more data. So for Bacon, he argues that travel is fundamental to the enterprise of science. And this new philosophy of travel was enormously influential.
And speaking of the similarities of philosophy and travel, both concepts are gendered male in the Western world. Is there gender equity in the two fields, or is it? Can we see it coming? Is it on the horizon? I know that you're particularly passionate about this area of thought.
I am. So I've spent a lot of time working on women in the history of philosophy. And certainly Western history of philosophy is overwhelmingly a male history. If you ask anyone on the street to name a philosopher, you'll get names like Plato, Socrates, Descartes, Kant. I would be astonished if you had a female name. There have in fact been women throughout the history of philosophy, but they have been systematically written out of Western histories of philosophy. Something that I've done in my philosophical work has been to try to recover some of these women, to highlight the fact that they existed and that their ideas were fascinating and complex and that they could move philosophy forwards in various ways. Mm-hmm. What happens when you have a history of a discipline that is so dominated by men, and that's exactly the same in travel as well as in philosophy, is that gender can attach to the concept of the discipline itself. And there's been a lot of research in philosophy showing that this has happened, that philosophy students think of philosophy as a male discipline, and that female students can assume that they will be less good at philosophy because they are not male. And this gendering of concepts, a more obvious example might be something like pinkness, which we associate with women, or motor cars that we associate with men, that philosophy and travel, because they are gendered male, I think that this still leads to big problems today. So in philosophy, women are still hugely underrepresented compared to other disciplines. And I think you see the same in travel. There are many wonderful women travellers, but if you look to lists of famous women travellers or prize-winning travel writers or anthologies of travel writing today, women are underrepresented.
Do you think that travelling is a utopian idea? Do we arrive with preconceived notions and impose them on a place? I mean, can we ever get a true sense of place as a traveller?
That's a lovely question. I think that we very often arrive with preconceived notions and of a place, and then the things that we perceive are filtered through those notions. And my sense is that that's going to be the same with almost everything that humans do, actually. So when we read literature, when we look to history, I think we are always approaching things with preconceived notions. I think we approach everything through the particular lens of who we are, what our background is, where we come from. Mm. That doesn't mean that it's not worth travelling or reading or doing history, because when you, even though you are seeing these things through your own lens, you're still getting stuff out of it, I think. You're still acquiring new knowledge, new information that you didn't have before. Mm. So I think even though it's impossible to approach places without these spectacles that we can't get rid of, it's still worth approaching them. Mm.
You talked earlier about your own sort of backpacking days, and I remember that for myself, where it was terribly important to make the distinction between being a traveller, which was something quite respected, and just being on holiday, which was something we despised.
That's very true. Yes, yeah. Certainly a sentiment I'm well familiar with.
Yes. But that is a thing.
Definitely, it's a thing. Absolutely. Yes, you want to be clear that you are not a mere tourist. You are, in fact, a backpacker. If I'm really honest, now that I'm a little bit older, I don't think there is such a distinction between being a tourist and being a backpacker. It seems to me
one's just dirtier and less comfortable.
I really do. What I will say is, though, that there are different forms of tourism. Backpacking is one of them. And one is dirtier and rougher and cheaper than the other. But I think there can also be value in the fact that it's harder. Say you go on an all-expenses-paid holiday to Spain, you wander around some cities with tour guides, you stay in extremely luxurious hotels and eat luxurious foods. That luxury might be of a kind that is familiar to you. So perhaps your tour guide is deliberately taking you to places that would be acceptable to a British palate, let's say. And I think what that experience can do is insulate you from the wonders of Spain. Whereas if you're going out and you're eating local foods and booking all your own bus tickets in bad Spanish, it seems to me that you're going to be soaking up the unfamiliar on a much deeper level. Now, that's not to say, I should add, that backpackers are necessarily doing that, because I have met plenty of backpackers who are, you know, hanging out with tribes of people from their own country and not doing very much else. But it seems like a way of doing it.
I mean, I know, I mean, class comes into it to a degree too. I mean, you have your kind of gap year traveller who perhaps has a bit more money. But also this goes right back, doesn't it, to the grand tours where it was wealthy young men setting off, on their European odyssey.
Yes, absolutely. So I think in the Western world, the origins of travel lie in the Grand Tour. And this really became popular in the mid-17th century, partly because Europe had seen lots of wars up until then. Once the fighting ceased, it was much easier for people to go off and travel. And this did happen amongst young noblemen across Europe, but it was predominantly a British phase. And what you get are these extremely wealthy, privileged young men who are ostensibly going abroad for their educations, almost as a kind of finishing school. You know, they've been in school up until now, but now they need to really refine their knowledge of languages and culture and history. Of course, the darker side to this is that the young men are often engaged in all kinds of debaucherous activities that was a lot easier for them to get hold of than it was back at home under the watchful eye of their parents.
Yeah. Just talking about travel now in the age of climate change and of coronavirus, the ethics of travel is something that we're really looking at. I mean, obviously people are criticised for excessive carbon footprints, but now also for spreading, you know, a virus. How ethical is travel?
I think in itself, there's nothing unethical about travel. Something I talk about in the book is the ethics of last chance to see travel. And this is the issue of visiting places like glaciers or coral reefs that might not survive that much longer, depending on how climate change goes. In itself, I don't think there's anything unethical about last chance to see tourism. If there was a rainbow outside the window and someone is telling you, look, it's going to go away soon, we should rush and see it, I think that's completely fine. Why not rush and take a look at the rainbow? The issue with last chance to see tourism is that the very act of visiting these places might actually hasten their demise. So visiting the coral reefs, visitors can damage them in non-obvious ways. So it's not just the worry about kicking them, it's the worry about leaving sunscreen residue in the water, in addition to the carbon footprint involved of going to visit these places. Travel in the age of coronavirus is going to be equally difficult, I think. So again, nothing unethical about travelling when a virus is happening. What's worrying here is that by travelling, you might further the spread of the virus. And then that starts to sound deeply unethical. Mm. There have been various news reports about, you know, youngsters taking advantage of cheap flights to jet off across the world. There are these near empty tourist destinations, which are going to be a big pull. I think the real worry is, are you going to be spreading the virus by taking advantage of these things?
Yeah. The book begins and ends with vintage travel tips, which I just thought was so lovely. Give us an idea of some of the ones at the beginning.
So I collected advice for travelling from a wide variety of sources, from philosophers, from vintage travel writers, and they have all kinds of wonderful things to say. So, for example, Plato argues that no one should travel under the age of 40, presumably because by that point we are going to be sensible enough to really take advantage of all the things that we can see. But Plato also is very worried about what might happen when you return home. So he doesn't want you to return home and spread dangerous ideas around. And he tells us very firmly that you must live as a private person on your return. And if you are found to be spreading any ideas, you must be put to death.
Good heavens.
Fan talk.
I particularly also like prohibit fools, furious people and women from travel.
Yes, absolutely. These things are not very PC today. Yes. And certainly on the women issue, I mean, it was widely believed that women should not travel, that women should be staying at home, keeping the hearth fires burning.
Finally, you end with the wonderful quote from T.S. Eliot. Would you give it to us?
I can. So Eliot says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time."
Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The Meaning of Travel by Emily Thomas is published by Oxford University Press, and it's out now. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hall and Madeline Pollard. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.